ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
We're going to talk about brain surgery. It's regarded as one of the most difficult things that a person can do, right up there with rocket science. It's always rocket science or brain surgery. Opening up the human head and operating on it. It's difficult and delicate work and dangerous if it goes wrong. But how long have we been doing it? And what can we do and what can't we do? We're going to talk about brain surgery this morning. And if you have any questions of a general rather than specific nature, unless, of course, you've undergone brain surgery, in which case we would love to hear about your own situation, and you can call us 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222, any questions about brain surgery, or text 0467-922-702, because we have a world-renowned expert, Dr. Julie, from the University of Arizona in Tucson, Dr. Julie Politsis is our very special guest. And, Doctor, a very good morning. Welcome to Overnight.
Thanks so much, Rod. It's my pleasure to be here.
Okay, so we hear about brain surgery as being the most difficult type of surgery. Is it? Is it really very, very difficult to do?
Well, Rod, I think, you know, as during your introduction, you know, you stole my quip about rocket science. And, you know, I think that's always the comparison that is made. With brain surgery, I think, you know, you have to be extremely precise. There's many years of training that go into this, oftentimes more than 8 years after medical school to get surgery. Certified. And, you know, and then, you know, I think as you go on in your career, you're always learning. What really makes it challenging is that the brain is so important. It's a part of our, heart and soul, so to speak. So it has so many functions, and just making sure to preserve those functions for our patients is really essential, and what keeps us going, and, you know, what the real challenge is.
What makes someone want to become a brain surgeon?
Well, you know, I can speak for myself. I just had a fascination with the human brain. When we're going through medical school, we learn about all the different organs, and, you know, others pick other organs. But for me, it's just no contest because the brain is so mysterious. We know what certain parts of it do in terms of function. But there's such a wide world out there of better understanding it. And really, you know, just it's the part of the body that makes us us. So I think that was really intriguing to me and why I went into the field.
I mentioned a moment ago, I asked the question, how long have we been doing it? How long have we been doing it? When did brain surgery as we know it first, you know, really become, part of what would happen in a major hospital?
Yes. So, any type of brain surgery actually dates back to, you know, the BC times, when there was the practice of making holes in the head to ward off evil spirits. So that was one of the times when it started. Fast forward, you know, to the 1800s, and we started to have better understanding just through science and through medicine of the function of different areas of the brain through, you know, kind of famous stories of patients that were affected by brain trauma. But really, it started right about the turn of the 1900s with the famous neurosurgeon Harvey Cushing, who really just started to practice very similarly in many ways to what we do today, and it really started instituting the practices that make this safe and efficacious.
Okay, so let's talk about what brain surgery actually is. What kind of surgery can be performed on the brain? Is it taking, you know, removing parts of the brain. You can't really replace parts of the brain. What can you actually do? Can you remove tumors and solve that kind of problem? When we're talking about brain surgery, what are we actually discussing?
Yeah. So, you know, this can be lots of different things. Oftentimes you're talking about things that are potentially life-saving, right? Like taking out a brain tumor, and that doesn't always have to be cancerous, but sometimes other masses grow in the brain. Very commonly, you know, there's people that have falls or some other form of trauma where they have a blood clot that needs to be removed. And, you know, that happens in more of an acute setting. Sometimes there's outpouching on the vessels called aneurysms that can rupture. And then those are another thing that needs to be taken care of. My particular area of expertise is improving, you know, abnormally functioning brain. So for patients with Parkinson's disease or essential tremor, we're actually able to treat some of the symptoms. So, you know, while we're not adding to the brain, we're improving function. And, you know, I find that highly rewarding as well.
So the brain controls all of our functions, obviously. If something has gone wrong somewhere, like say with Parkinson's disease and other diseases of that nature, is that because something's gone wrong in the brain? And if you isolate that or, you know, concentrate on that, you are able to do something about it?
Yeah. So, you know, right now with our understanding of Parkinson's disease, there's an abnormal circuit. So, you know, we think about people that have a stroke and maybe they can't move one side of their body. But if you have Parkinson's disease, you're moving that side inappropriately, either too much or too little. And so by, you know, stimulating areas that are involved in that disrupted circuit, we're able to stop those movements and normalize them. This isn't a cure for Parkinson's disease, but it helps in improving the symptoms.
So if that happens, how often do you need to go and stimulate that part of the brain or remove a little part of it, perhaps? I don't know. How often does that need to happen? Because people who are suffering Parkinson's disease, and there are increasing numbers of them, you know, they would love any good news about this.
Yeah. So, you know, we put the device in and it's, you know, about 20% of the people that have Parkinson's are a candidate for this surgery. We put the device in the brain and, you know, it's one brain surgery, which is a big deal, but it's just that one time. And then it connects to a battery that looks very much like a pacemaker battery for the heart. And so the stimulation is nonstop through that battery in the chest. Sometimes that battery needs to be replaced, but, you know, that's a 15 to 20 minute procedure, and it doesn't involve going back into the brain.
So besides Parkinson's, what other diseases are treated like that?
Yeah. So, you know, there's other movement disorders. Essential tremor is actually much more prevalent than Parkinson's disease. And so that's another one. Dystonia is very uncommon and, you know, oftentimes can happen in children, but it can happen in older adults. Excitingly, we do this, you know, for obsessive compulsive disorder in well-selected patients, as well as epilepsy. So those are all candidates where you know, we've investigated whether this can be used for major depression, and there's a lot of promising results in that avenue.
So if we know then what part of the brain affects those disorders or those diseases, why can't we take out that little part of the brain so that it doesn't affect you?
Yeah. So in Parkinson's disease in particular, we are really, you know, we're pretty advanced. So in fact, what you can do in areas that are affected by Parkinson's is you can make a hole in that part of the brain in order to treat some of the symptoms. We did this in the past, if you've heard of thalidomotomy or pallidotomy, but now we're doing this through, you know, kind of what's a hot topic right now called focused ultrasound. And so you are actually able to do that. You know, there's some issue with doing it on both sides. So if the Parkinson's affects you on both sides, you're going to want to talk to your neurosurgeon and your neurologist about whether you're a candidate for deep brain stimulation or focused ultrasound. But, you know, that's an area where we can do this. Unfortunately, we aren't as knowledgeable yet about particular areas that control other diseases. So, you know, those treatment for those areas are lagging behind a little bit.
But I suppose given that, you know, there is some part of the brain that affects, you know, every part of our body, then it's just a matter of tracking down or finding where in your brain that part of the brain affects that part of the body and doing something. Is that the same sort of thing? If it can be done for Parkinson's disease, then it can be done for these other ones.
Yeah. And I think we're really excited about that promise. You know, one of the ways we can figure this out is, you know, not everybody's brain is the same. While we have general regions in the brain that do the same thing, the exact location may differ in my brain than in your brain. And, you know, so sometimes what we'll do is get an MRI, like while you're doing certain activities, called a functional MRI, to nail down exactly where that spot is. And so, you know, we've tried for certain diseases, tried to stimulate that area. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is in most diseases, it's not just one area. So it's multiple areas. And then you have to kind of figure out the interaction between them. But, you know, we're well on our way to doing this. And, you know, the new technology and imaging, as well as AI, is really going to move this forward.
Christine has texted in 0467 922 702. Christine says, I had a craniotomy due to a fall in 2016. I had an acute on chronic subdural hematoma, therefore reason for the craniotomy. I was dying when they operated and didn't even know they'd operated. Here I am over 70 years old and have come through that surgery and doing well with no side effects. So thankful for the skill of the neurosurgeon's hand and mind. There you go. That's from Christine. So that is for when obviously she had a fall, hit her head, and something had to be done. How easy is it to fix parts of the brain that are injured, you know, in that way? I mean, I don't know how serious Christine's fall was, but obviously have people, you know, with serious car accidents or perhaps have been assaulted or perhaps fell over, you're going to have a different range of injuries, but how easily are they treated?
Yeah. So, you know, Christine actually had probably one of the most common operations we do. So here in, you know, Arizona, we're in the top 10 of the busiest trauma centers in the states. And in fact, you know, 65% of the trauma that we see is just like what Christine experienced, you know, with a fall. And, you know, now oftentimes people are on blood thinners and other things, which can make a fall, you know, even more problematic if you hit your head, because that can cause an issue. So what's fortunate in these cases is that that you don't have bleeding in the brain, but you have bleeding rather between the brain and the skull. And when you have these the blood clots that are in that area, you don't have to go into the brain itself. You know, neurosurgeons still do this procedure. And I will tell you, some of the most rewarding cases we have are in these cases. So, you know, if you hit your head on something and you're not quite right and you know, continue to have headaches, especially if you're on blood thinners, you know, make sure you talk to your doctor, because, you know, this is something that you should have in the back of your mind.
We're talking about brain surgery this morning, and Julie Politsis is our guest, Dr. Julie Politsis from the University of Arizona in Tucson. We may take some calls on this. If you've had this situation and you might want to tell us about your experience, 1-300-800-222. Also text us as well. Pamela said she had a car accident which resulted in a stroke. 6-week coma. They performed a decompression craniotomy to release pressure on my swollen brain from the crash. Here I am 33 years later, disabled, but alive and enjoying life and my 12 grandchildren. Thank you for that, Pamela. I'm terribly sorry about what happened. What happens? What's the difference between performing brain surgery on someone who's in a coma or in that kind of state and people who aren't?
Yeah. You know, so I think one of the things that, you know, we do, especially when somebody comes in acutely like Christine or Pamela, is, you know, we have a rating score to look at, you know, how seriously injured they may be. And there's a lot of things that can go into this because, you know, say you're in a car accident, you know, you might have other injuries besides the brain injury. So sometimes you have to look at that number a little bit differently. You know, what we generally do is, you know, when the people come into the emergency, we end up, you know, getting a CAT scan and seeing what the issue is. And, you know, often it's like Christine's case where it's the blood clot outside. And, you know, sometimes it's like Pamela's case where you say, oh, you know, gosh, this is something that, you know, I can't take out a blood clot and solve this problem right away. But if I can give her more space for the brain, that may be very helpful. And, you know, so that's what it sounds like the doctors did in that case. And, you know, that allowed the brain to go about its normal function and deal with that swelling, which tends to get worse in the first 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. Colleen wants to know whether severe Tourette syndrome is treatable using brain surgery.
Great question, Colleen. And, you know, so when you have Tourette syndrome, you know, this is something that we do deep brain stimulation for in certain people. This is one of these cases, just like anything else we do with Parkinson's or any other indication for deep brain stimulation, we work in a team. So we work with the neurologist, the psychologist, and, you know, often social work and others to figure out if you're a candidate. And because we only want to offer this to people that we're going to make better and that are really going to be thankful for having undergone this. And so we discuss your case and often have multiple doctors see you to determine whether you're a candidate for this procedure. So you may be. And, you know, I would recommend, you know, talking with your neurologist or psychologist to see if, you know, what they know and what their experience has been. And, you know, then maybe talking to a neurosurgeon about it as well.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's support groups for people with Tourette syndrome who would also, I'm sure, I mean, it sounds like Colleen may be in this situation or know somebody who has. And if that's the case, then you know, they would know people within that support group that would give them advice on that. Let's talk to Ruby in Brisbane. Good morning, Ruby.
Good morning.
Yes, Ruby, you had brain surgery. What happened?
I actually have. I was very lucky and I'm very grateful for the care I had. I have two aneurysms right near in my inner carotid artery, I think it's called. It's yep. Near Circle of Willis, which is not a good place to have these aneurysms. No. Mm-hmm. Mine were very large, so usually they coil aneurysms, but mine were too large, so I had something quite different. It was called pipeline stents that they used. I had a 10-hour operation. Everything was done through my groin. It was just amazing. Like they put stents in your heart.
Yeah.
Some way these magical people knew the way to get up to my brain.
Wow.
I have two aneurysms. They were about 8 mil big each. They usually don't get much bigger than 4 or 5. And it took 3 pipeline stents. But you know what? I'm alive. I'm very grateful. A public hospital saved my life. And
I will say also that is one of the great things about the Australian health system is that you could have it done in a public hospital.
Absolutely. If you are very unwell, then they will do all that they can to help you. So, yeah, I just felt compelled to ring because
thank you, Ruby.
Hey, not many people have had brain surgery.
Can I ask you, I mean, how did you know? Did you have headaches? How did you?
Yes, yeah. I was very unwell. And this is another thing I would like to stress. I was very unwell for a long time. I was doing a physical job and I started getting migraines and vomiting while I was at work. And I just kept going to the doctor, and they couldn't work out really. They did a CT scan but didn't pick anything up.
Right.
They thought it was really in my sinuses. You know what I did? I went and got a second opinion. And I think everyone should listen to their body.
Yep.
And if you feel that something's just not quite right, I went to a second opinion. He sent me for a CT scan. 20 minutes later, they rang me.
Wow.
Went back to the doctors, and he told me that I had aneurysm in my brain.
How did you feel when you heard that?
I was relieved because I thought they were going to tell me I had a tumour. And for some reason, I don't know, like,
yeah.
It's pretty horrible what I had. But, yeah, I was quite calm, really, considering.
You sound pretty calm now. How long ago was this, Ruby?
It was 11 years, yeah.
Okay.
So I had it. Yeah, life's different for me now. Like, I am unable to drive because I do have seizures from time to time.
Right.
Yeah, and so
it's more price
days
to pay.
Are very different. Yeah, I have trouble with organisation and some trouble with my speech. But I'm so grateful. These people are so clever. And, yeah, I just felt compelled to ring and
thank you very
share
much,
my
Ruby.
Story.
Julie, you got anything you wanted to talk to Ruby about?
Well, Ruby, thank you for being an inspiration to everybody that's on the line. And, you know, I think you really brought home such a great point where, you know, I think that doctors see a lot of things that are very common all the time. And, you know, so when you're having headaches, you know, sinus is like a common thing. But when you know something is wrong with your body, absolutely do what you did and advocate for yourself. Or, you know, hopefully, you know, you can have family members do it. But way to go knowing that, you know, something was wrong with you and getting the care you need.
Thank you so
Thank
much for
you.
That, Ruby. And of course, we wish you the very best for your health. This is Overnights on ABC Radio, and you are with Rod Quinn. We're talking to a brain surgeon, Dr. Julie Politsis at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Just tell us then about what Ruby was talking about when she was relieved that it wasn't a tumour. The differences between a tumour and an aneurysm, the fact she had two aneurysms, whether that was unusual, and then they went in via her groin. That seems like that's a remarkable thing as well, and the fact they didn't have to drill into a brain. Just go take us through what happens with aneurysms.
Yeah. So, you know, aneurysms are the outpouching of the vessel. So there's a weakness in a vessel wall. And, you know, what the concern is that, you know, this aneurysm or this outpouching could rupture. You know, Ruby was very knowledgeable. And, you know, what she said was, you know, that hers became 8 millimeters. And, you know, when you have a 4 millimeter one, you know, these are often things we can watch because there's a very, very, very low risk of them, you know, having any issue. But when they get to the size that Ruby's was, it's important to treat them. So even, you know, when I started along my neurosurgery journey, you know, 20 plus years ago, we did craniotomies and open surgery for these. And now what has become really much more common, as she alluded to, was an angiogram type procedure. So similar to what people have if they have heart disease.
Yeah.
You go in through the groin and you're able to thread a wire up to the area here. She was talking about her carotid artery. So in the front of her neck and a little bit higher as you go into the brain. And, you know, then you get a dye study and you see what's going on. And what they were able to do was a stent, which is a way of redirecting the blood flow that allows these aneurysms to go away. Because they're no longer being outpouched because the blood isn't causing the pressure on them.
8 millimeters. I know, as you know, you and Ruby were saying, that was kind of twice as big as a normal one, perhaps. But 8 millimeters is still very, very small, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and I think that's a When you had asked, what makes brain surgery challenging, it's that, there's these very small things that can cause very major problems. So, when you're talking about this aneurysm size, 8 millimeters is small to any of our eyes. Or when you're talking about some of these areas in the brain that you want to stimulate for Parkinson's, that can be like 5 millimeters. So it's the precision to get to these really small areas and treat them appropriately.
We're talking about brain surgery this morning. Brian in Belmont has texted in, and people feel free to text in 0467 922 702. He says there have been some advancements for dementia patients. Tell me then about what we know about brain stimulation, that's your field of expertise, when it comes to dementia.
So, there were, we obviously got really excited because of the phenomenal results of deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's. So we have tried this in clinical trials to see if it can help other things. And, so Alzheimer's dementia is such a devastating disease that affects many people. And there was, what we tried to do was stimulate other areas of the brain that are involved in memory formation. I will say that, the results of the trial, didn't meet endpoint, meaning that, the goal that was set in advance of the trial, we didn't get to where we wanted to go. Having said that, there was some promise about this. So people are still looking into it. There has recently been something even more exciting, and it was, aired on a recent U.S. episode of 60 Minutes, where now one of the things they can do is using this focused ultrasound that I had mentioned before, you're able to actually open up the blood-brain barrier, which is a protective mechanism of the brain, but can also make it very difficult for drugs and therapies to get through. And the hope is by administering, some of the drugs we've had in the past and or new drugs, by opening up the area that is affected by Alzheimer's, that we can really make inroads.
Okay. So much to talk to you about. And Iris would like to talk as well. G'day, Iris.
Hello, Rod. How are you?
I'm very well. You've also had brain surgery, a craniotomy.
Yes, I did about 10 years ago. I was diagnosed with a tumour called an acoustic neuroma. It was about 3 centimetres in size. But why I wanted to ring in was that basically one of the other callers mentioned that just listening to your body, because it took about 9 months and 3 attempts to get a diagnosis, and because my symptoms were so vague.
What kind of symptoms were they, Iris?
I had what was called asymmetric hearing loss. So I couldn't hear properly in my left ear. And apparently the tumour had been there for about 20 years.
Oh.
And I only picked it up because I couldn't put my headphones, well, I couldn't hear properly in one of my headphones. And I always thought that my headphone wasn't sitting inside my ear properly, and the volume, I couldn't hear it in my left ear. And apparently that is one of the symptoms, which I found out later on. But basically, after an MRI, they found it straight away. So,
You're okay today? Just,
other than having no hearing in my left ear, I had another surgery where I had a titanium implant put in for a something called a Baha, a bone anchored hearing aid. So I, again, amazing technology. I can hear sound on the left hand side of my head in my right ear. Like it's just, we have really amazing medical services here. And that's one thing as well, that when I had the surgery, I got the best care under Medicare and an amazing neurosurgeon and ENT specialist. Like it was just, I feel very, very fortunate to have had that. So yeah.
Iris,
but apart from that, I'm still, go, go, go.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that, Iris. Let's talk to Amber from Parramatta. Hello, Amber.
Oh, good evening. Good morning. The brain is just a fascinating organ. It just, but it's not completely, sort of sometimes we feel in charge of it and sometimes we don't. But my one question is, should things be relegated to the past sometimes rather than continue Like I've been told people who've had ECT, for instance, have found it very unsatisfactory, and they're very disgruntled that they went through it.
Okay. All righty, Amber. Thank you very much for that. Julie Politzis from the University of Arizona. So ECT, electroshock therapy, people might also call it. What effect does that have on the brain? And, I mean, it's kind of coming back in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, so ECT, you know, has been used for a very long time. You know, we may be going on, you know, just shy of a century of use. And, you know, I think there have been modern advancements, and this can be really helpful for a lot of people that are really suffering. When you talk about ECT, as opposed to, you know, some of the precision we're talking about when we're talking about 5 or 8 millimeters, ECT is a global process generally where the shock is delivered, you know, across the brain. And in many reasons, this is because when we talk about depression, which is a common reason for people to undergo ECT, many areas are affected. So, and that's also going to differ from patient to patient. So, you know, I think that because it's so widespread and because patients are vary, you know, everybody has, you know, a little bit of a different story, as you heard from all the callers from today. You know, I think that's why it can be so remarkable in some cases, and in other cases, you know, maybe as Amber was saying, you know, that the people were a little bit less satisfied.
There's so much, again, I say we've got to talk to you about. One of them is a text from Merv, who lives near Cobar in Western New South Wales. He wants to ask about footballers. Now, that is very, very high profile at the moment. Concussions of footballers and other sports people, not only in Australia, but in the US and around the world. What can be done about that? Can traumas like concussions be operated on?
Yeah. So, you know, I think this is something that, again, has become such a hot topic of people talking about. And I think that's great. And I think that awareness is really what we need to do to help solve the problem, because this is something where we want to talk about prevention, because there are less options when it actually happens. So how do we prevent this? You know, I think that making sure that everybody uses their protective wear when indicated, making sure that we enforce rules where there's clearly a high probability of somebody having this kind of injury. And then, you know, I think being more reliable on our assessments on the field and erring on the side of caution when this, you know, is a possibility is essential.
But that's preventing. And obviously, prevention is better than cure. But you're saying that for people, like some high-profile footballers in Australia might have had 10 or more than 10, a dozen or more than that, concussions during their career, and they still play on. There's nothing you can do to sort of repair the damage?
No, you know, I think, you know, it's like any, you know, think about if you had a broken bone, right? And then, you know, it may heal well the first time, but then if you keep on breaking that bone, you know, eventually it's not going to heal as well. Nice. So, you know, unfortunately, at this point, prevention and awareness is, you know, where we're at. We are making headway. You know, recently, a new blood test, like very recently in the last week or two, a new blood test came on the market, and, you know, to see if it can diagnose concussion more accurately. Because one of the problems here is, you know, it's really dependent on, you know, the examiner and the patient being examined. So to take some of that subjectivity out is the first step. And, you know, I will say that there is a lot of research going on in this topic to figure out, you know, what can be done after, you know, in terms of the treatment aspect. Yeah. But now, you know, it's in research status.
I bet there's a lot going on, because there's a lot of major, you know, football team owners, and there's a lot of money involved in this, and they are trying to solve this problem because the last thing they want is for people not to play their sport, because it brings in a lot of money. One of the things we often hear, though, with, say, with concussion is, you know, they have a mandatory stand-down period now. So it could be, you know, 2 weeks or so before you're allowed to get back on the field. Does that make a difference?
Yes. So, you know, I think that it is really important to follow those rules, because what you're doing is you're giving the brain time to heal itself. So, you know, I think, again, using the bone analogy, and, you know, maybe it wouldn't happen in 2 weeks if you broke your leg, but think about at least, you know, healing that area before you go out and try again.
Okay. We've got Anne on the phone as well. G'day, Anne. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I had an aneurysm, which was discovered quite by accident when I was being treated for something totally unrelated. Now, this, and they actually went in through my skull. This aneurysm was about 4 centimetres from my right eyebrow, which I got hit with a hockey ball years before. And I wondered if that could be in relation to being hit, you know, the aneurysm from that.
Okay. Well, I will say, of course, at the moment that, you know, anything we say is of a general nature only, and you understand that. That's okay. But, okay.
The aneurysm was 7 millimetres.
All right. Julie, I mean, brain trauma, does that sometimes cause aneurysms?
It can. And, you know, so when you are hit with something, you know, what we normally see is, you know, say you were in a bad motor vehicle accident and hit with some force, depending on where you're hit, we sometimes, very rarely, see an outpouching or a vessel injury that can occur and an aneurysm. I would say that most of the time when this happens and it's related to the trauma, something is picked up at the time where we notice an abnormality in the vessel, you know, either immediately or within a week or two. So usually they're closer related in that it happens soon after the trauma as opposed to years later.
Okay. Are you all right now, Anne? Are you okay?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's good. Well, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We're talking about brain surgery this morning. Dr. Julie Politsis is our guest from Arizona. Now, a couple of other text messages. Helen in Geelong says, what about dystonia treatments? You might need to explain what they are.
Yeah. So dystonia is what, you know, one of the things that, you know, can be treated by deep brain stimulation. So dystonia is, there's two types. And so there's a primary dystonia, which is something that you're born with, where there was a gene abnormality that caused, you know, involuntary muscle movements and or stiffening and tightness. Then there's what's called secondary dystonia, you know, and probably one of the most familiar examples of this is when somebody gets like writer's cramp, where you're doing a motion and then something abnormal happens when you repeat that motion. And so that's the secondary dystonia. So generally, you know, if you have either of the two of those, you're going to go to a neurologist that specializes in movement disorders. And, you know, sometimes they'll do the genetic testing. It can be quite expensive. So sometimes they will, or sometimes they'll just take a good family history to figure out if anybody else in the family has it, and then hear a little bit more about your symptoms. And then I would say, you know, there's a number of medications that can be used for it. When these cases are severe, the next step that people move to quickly is Botox injections of the area. So that's very popular and often a good treatment for that. In cases when Botox doesn't work, you may be referred to me or a neurosurgeon to look at, you know, deep brain stimulation or some other surgical options to help. But, you know, like with anything, of course, if you don't want to, you know, if medication works or something non-invasive works, you want to do that absolutely first, you know, and reserve this for if you absolutely needed it.
Do you think perhaps doctors are too cautious in trying new methods? We've got a high profile case in Australia at the moment with a well-known doctor who has brain cancer, and he is undergoing, you know, revolutionary treatment, really, because, you know, he's his own patient in a way, and, you know, he has kind of given himself permission to do this. Do you think we need more of that sort of thing to see what works and what doesn't work?
What an interesting question. You know, I think that, you know, I think doctors are trained, you know, to first do no harm. And so I think that's something that, you know, is ingrained upon us. And, you know, so I think that that may be, you know, some of the conservative nature. Having said that, you know, I think where one of the questions that I really like when patients ask me is, you know, what would you do if this was you? Or what would you do if this was your mom or your husband or your child? And, you know, I think that's a great question that people can ask their doctor and, you know, will may, you know, help get over that doctor's bias to do no harm first.
Where are we with lobotomy these days? It was popular, you know, 80 years ago or so, maybe more recently than that, taking out parts of the brain in an attempt to cure some problems. Does it still go on, and did it work?
Yeah. So, you know, lobotomies generally were done, you know, for depression or for other psychiatric indications. And I think part of the problem with them historically is we were not cautious enough on which patients we did this for. And, you know, I think with any of these treatments, you know, the doctor has to look at you and your disease and come up with an individualized treatment plan for you. You know, now what we try to do when we're talking about any of the psychiatric indications is really use this team approach. We have much better technology to look at what part of the brain is abnormal. You know, in rare, in some cases, you know, we've tried this stimulation for this. There are other cases where, you know, we are, as opposed to taking something out, you know, where we're burning a hole in the brain, and that can be done, you know, without open surgery, which makes it a little bit more tolerable. So I would say, yes, we're still doing psychiatric surgery, but not at nearly the how frequently it was done in the past. And, you know, I think this is an area where when you talk about, you know, maybe getting a little bit more aggressive, you know, I think the pendulum has swung from one part too far to the other way too far. And, you know, I think this is something that we need to keep in the back of our minds.
Okay. Because, you know, there have been horror stories about it. Did it work, though?
So, yeah, you know, and I think there's such a bias because there were these horror stories. And I think you have to put this in perspective of what was going on at the time, right? You know, this was after World War II. You know, the hospitals were inundated with people who had suffered such things and such traumas, you know, mentally. And so there were a lot of overpopulation of mental institutions. And, you know, so people were just trying to help, like an overwhelming kind of public health crisis. So, you know, I think, yes, it works in the people that are appropriate for having had it. But, you know, I think when you're in a public health crisis like that, you're not, you need to narrow down which are those people that should have these treatments.
So I read a text from Pamela earlier about the fact that she had a car accident and a stroke, and they performed the craniotomy on her while she was in a coma. She says, furthermore, the piece of my skull removed was approximately the size of a flat hand. I could feel my brain through my skin. And about 6 months later, when my brain had shrunk again, I had to go back to the hospital where they had my bone in a jar and they put it back in. How common would that be?
So, not as uncommon as you would think. You know, so what, you know, when you think about the skull, you know how everybody knows how hard it is, probably more in some people than in others, but you know, it's a enclosed space. So your brain is already there and that's filling up most of the space. And then there's some fluid filling up the space. And so when you have a trauma and you add something else to that space, that can put a real pressure on the brain. So what we do is try to make more space by taking off that skull. And, you know, this is in people that have very bad head injuries or very bad strokes. And historically, what we've done is, you know, we will take out the bone and it actually will go into a freezer, you know, that is protected from all the elements and can be replaced. And, you know, if that's an option for you, you know, having your own bone there is, you know, probably the best option because it's yours. What we will do in some cases is, you know, if the bone was damaged or infected or anything else, we can create a prosthesis there. And, you know, that's what's replaced instead.
Got another great question from Ron in Padstow. G'day, Ron.
How are you going?
Not too bad. What would you like to know?
I suppose it's a bit hypothetical, but, you know, you hear about, I think there was some woman caught under the ice and she was under there for something like 30 minutes and came back. But if someone was, I suppose, technically cryogenically frozen, as they're all getting on the bandwagon, could the brain, hypothetically, in time, be re-energized or rebooted, for want of a better word?
Good question. Okay, Julie, people want to live forever. They might have a disease. They get cryogenically frozen, brought back once we discover a cure for the disease. Is it in any way possible? People who are cryogenically frozen have their brains and their bodies frozen. I mean, is there anything to that?
Yeah, you know, I think that Ron brings up a great point about, you know, when the body is cold, like this woman in the ice, brain function can return because everything has slowed down. And, you know, we know that, you know, in the case that he was mentioning, you know, maybe she was gone for 30 minutes and, you know, maybe had she not been cold, it would be like 10 or 15 minutes. So, you know, we're able to see differences with that short amount of time. Now, relative, you know, in terms of, you know, minutes, we're still talking about. So, you know, while I think, you know, hypothetically, way in the future, this is something that, you know, I think intrigues us all. We are still talking in the minute time frame, not in the hours or days or weeks or year time frame.
Decades in the case of some people. Thanks very much for that, Ron. Good question. Ian in Sydney would like you, Julie, to talk about the consequences of the brain injury CTE. That's something we hear a lot about with footballers, and that is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, that is repeated head injuries. And we're told it can't really be diagnosed until after death and the brain is removed and examined, and then people could say, yes, this person was suffering from CTE. Are we getting to a point where now it can be diagnosed prior to death?
I think, you know, I think we're getting to the point where this can be a clinical diagnosis. You know, there's not a blood test or an MRI specific finding for this, but at the same time, you know, if somebody has had a history of these many concussions and you're seeing things that are, you know, behavioral changes that are just like people are becoming people that you don't know. And, you know, they've had the personality changes or the memory changes. You know, I think with a good clinical history, as well as sometimes, you know, a battery of tests working with our neuropsychologists, you know, we can give diagnosis as, you know, more likely than not. So, you know, I think that to confirm it, you know, that's similar to Alzheimer's. Oftentimes, you know, you have to wait until after death. But I think people are now so much more aware of this and know the right questions to ask and the right testing clinically to do.
Elizabeth in Perth wants to know about the role that statin medications play in Alzheimer's or dementia. Is that something you can comment on?
You know, I can't comment too much on it. I will say that, you know, statins are an interesting drug that, you know, it can kind of go both ways, right? So when you're talking about dementia, you have, you know, Alzheimer's dementia, but one of the other types of dementia you have is, you know, if you had repeated strokes or a lack of blood going to the brain, and that can happen because, you know, you have some cardiovascular kind of compromise. So, you know, in those cases, if you know you have a lot of heart disease and vascular disease, and your doctor's recommending, you know, for your heart health that you're on a statin, I absolutely think that will help the brain because generally what's good for the heart is good for the brain. Having said that, you know, I think that statins, you know, sometimes people can't tolerate taking them in the short term. So it's a little bit ironic that it can help, you know, sometimes in the long term, but in the short term, people will report, you know, having memory loss and some issues. And then you want to talk to your doctor about whether, you know, a statin is something you really need. You know, sorry to kind of answer that both
That's all right.
ways, but I think the good mantra there is what's good for the heart is good for the brain.
And probably our final question. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Carol says she wants to talk about brain stimulation as well, that she developed tremors in her early 70s. She takes, you know, medication for it, but is wondering if there's anything more permanent for people with tremors.
Yes, yeah, so you know what I would recommend to you is to talk to your primary care doctor about sending you to a movement disorder neurologist or a neurosurgeon that specializes in procedures. So you know I think that the one they're, what they're going to assess is you know whether your tremor is severe enough to you know warrant any of these procedures. So and what do I mean by that? You know, if this is something where you're trying to eat or drink and you know you're spilling all over the place or you can't write or do things that you want, you know, that's probably that is. And you know, I think you know, in that case, you know, what you're gonna talk to them about is, okay, are there any kind of stronger medications or is deep brain stimulation a possibility, or is this focused ultrasound a possibility?
Once again, we should point out, of course, that any advice that Julie has given is of a general nature. And, of course, as Julie points out, go and see your own medical specialist and they will tell you whether or not you are in a position to have that treatment. This must be, you know, for the operations that you do as well, this must be an incredibly rewarding when you see people who've come in with terrible problems. And because of the way that surgery has advanced, you're able to help them lead a normal life.
Yeah, no, Rod, actually, you know, as people have been calling in today, you know, I've thought several times, you know, just how fortunate I am to be able to help my fellow man and woman in this role. So absolutely, just to make a difference. And you heard some of these stories today. It really, you know, warms your heart that you're able to help people in their like most desperate times.
Are we advancing all the time? Are we going to be better at this in a year from now, 5 years from now than we are now?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, with the rise of AI and how rapidly that's changing, I think that, you know, we're gonna not only advance, but advance more quickly than we ever have before.
It is remarkable. Julie Politzis, thank you so much for giving so much of your time to us this morning. Thank you for your great work, and I really look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure, and I'm really happy to do anything I can for you and your community. Thanks, Rod.
That is Dr. Julie Politzis from the University of Arizona in Tucson.
ABC Listen, podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.